You can all see the banner here.
Acceptance, the key to recovery. When the committee met and we decided on this theme, I said, the key to recovery. And they said, you do not need the word the. I said, I need the word the. To me, it is the key to recovery. It's not a key. It's not one of the keys to me. I mean, I know it's different for other people, but it is the key. And so they let me do that. They told me it was redundant. And I know all you people that know good grammar and all that kind of stuff, I know we didn't need the V, but I wanted it. And they let me get away with it, even put it on the banner. But the reason for that, like I said, is it was important to me. Because in my recovery, it has been the key. And I wanted that on our program and on our banner. And so we have it. I was looking in our service manuals and in Al-Anon and Al-Ateen groups at work when it talks about our three legacies. And I saw something I had never noticed before as many times as I've looked at that. Under recovery, you know, we always say recovery is the steps, unity the traditions, and service the concepts. And I had never seen this in there before, but it says recovery through acceptance of the steps. And I didn't know acceptance was in there. But I found it the other day, and I thought, you know, just about everything that I have had to deal with since I got into this program, everything, the situations that have come up in my life, I've discovered that it's acceptance that gets me where I need to be. You know, acceptance is the only real source of serenity and peace for me. I have to totally surrender and totally accept before I get okay, or before I have any peace or any serenity. And of course, we do this through the steps, and step one is surrender to me. When I can admit that I'm powerless. I'm the kind of person that I tell y'all this when y'all elected me chairman. I've always loved to run the show. But I didn't know what I was getting into when you elected me chairman. But it's been fun. I've had a ball today. I've run around here like a chicken with my head chopped off. And I've just had a ball. I don't know if I've done what I was supposed to do, but it's been fun. But, I've always been the kind of person that I like to control things. I like to run the show, like I said. And when I got, and I was doing that before I got into Al-Anon, and I still do it some, but when I first heard the Serenity Prayer, and I heard people talking, you know, about accepting the things you cannot change, and courage to change the things you can, I had never even thought about accepting anything unless I fixed it the way I wanted it to begin with. So I've had to learn that there's a lot of things I have to accept, especially other people and things they do. And the Serenity Prayer has been my lifesaver, I guess, in this program. I have to learn that, you know, that I can't change other people, but I can change myself through the help of my higher power. You know, to me, acceptance means simply admitting there are things I cannot change. That's as simple as I know how to make it for me. And when I heard courage to change the things I can, I thought, I've got more courage than anybody I know. This is how I thought of myself at the time. And I thought, that just told me, okay, you can still change these other people. You can still change this alcoholic. You can still change things, you know. And so I had to go back and say, wait a minute. And my sponsor at that time said, Linda, when you pray the Serenity Prayer, you need to add something to yourself, excuse me. It says, when you say, accept the things you cannot change, and change the things you can, she said, you need to add about yourself, about myself, that you cannot change anybody but yourself. And I really do that. When I pray the Serenity Prayer, I have to do that. I have to say that I, you know, remind myself that I can't change anybody but me. So, and, you know, wisdom to know the difference, and that gets to the point. Some of the workshops, if you've looked at your program, some of the workshops are about a lot of the stuff we're talking about this weekend, about acceptance. There's one that says wisdom, mine or God's. And I had always run the show, and I thought that I had always relied on my higher power, the God as I understand him. And I didn't realize that I wasn't looking for the answers. I was too busy running the show, and that I needed to listen and look to God for the answer and for the wisdom to know what to do. And, you know, I found with changing people and not changing people and this controlling thing, I found it's real simple for me. And that is that I'm the only person I can change. And the wisdom to know the difference is, the wisdom is, if something's going on and I look at it and I'm trying to fix this other person, then God's telling me that's not right. But if it's something, then I need to look at me, and if something's wrong to me, with me, I need to fix me. And so that's where my wisdom comes in. A lot of it is being real simple with it and saying, uh-oh, can I change that? Or can I change them? If I can't, then I need to change myself. And so that's where I am. And then one of the workshops is acceptance, submission, or surrender. And, you know, I used to think that acceptance meant that I was submitting to a degrading situation. And, you know, it says in our One Day at a Time book that it doesn't mean that we're submitting to a degrading situation, but we're just accepting the facts of the situation and then deciding what to do about it. And so it's not, you know, submission's different to me than surrender, because surrender means relinquishing our self-will and accepting God's will and His help. And that's really what I've had to learn to do. I can't do this by myself. I could not even stand up here before you by myself. I can't run the show. I can't control everything. But with the help of a power greater than me, and when I can turn my will over to Him, then I'm able to get up and do these things. And like I said, it's just been great doing it. I just want to thank y'all from the bottom of my heart letting me be chairman. I've had a good time. Of course, I'll tell you the key. You find the best co-chairman in the world and get her to stand, get her elected, and she does all the work. That's what's happened. Dorothy, your co-chairman and chairman for next year, she's not the only one. I had a great committee, and they have really, really worked hard. But Dorothy has done a lot of things for me because she lives in Moultrie, so she's near Norman Park, and she's done a lot of the work. And I'm real grateful, and I want to tell the committee how much I appreciate them. But anyway, these are just some of my thoughts on one of the workshops is letting go of the need to control. And I found that I really had a need to control everything. And that's what I was talking about a while ago. I had to learn that, hey, you know, things will get done if you don't do it. You know, you don't have to do it. And I had to look at why I needed this so badly and this control. And I've learned, you know, I've got a lot more peace and a lot more serenity than I've ever had, because I can just accept things. I don't have to get in there and fix everything and everybody. And things might not go my way, and most of the time it doesn't, but that's okay. Most of the time I'm okay with it today. I can accept it. You know, there's really no real acceptance if you're still struggling to change people, places, and things. I'm really not accepting things. And I've really got to surrender to get to the point that I can just let people be who they are and what they are, and that I can let situations go on and I don't have to get in there and change them. When I can accept situations as they are, not as I wish them to be, then I can begin to grow and have serenity and peace of mind. I know a lot of you, well, not a lot of you, but some of you, it was hot today, and you got here, and you got real frustrated trying to get checked in, and your room wasn't ready, or you didn't get the room you wanted, and all that kind of stuff. And somebody laughed and said to me this afternoon and said, oh, well, acceptance, acceptance. And I said, yeah, acceptance. We can't have it all just like we want it. We tried to do the best we could with everybody, but sometimes there's things that we just have to accept, whether we like them or not. There's a lot of things I have to accept I don't like. But anyway, I'm going to move on. This, I want to close with this. I just wanted to tell you some of the thoughts, like I said, on this theme that we came up with, and what we'll be talking about this weekend is this acceptance, and the workshops, like I say, I mentioned a few of them, are on this theme. And I've got some good people, I think, doing the workshops, and they're going to be great. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with it, but the long form of the Serenity Prayer, listen very carefully to the words as I read it. We're real familiar with what we say at meetings all the time, but listen to the rest of the Serenity Prayer and what it's saying about surrender, what it's saying about self-will and God's will, and what it's saying about accepting things you can't change and living at peace. But I'm going to close with this, so listen very carefully to this. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as the pathway to peace, taking, as he did, this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Amen. So I'm going to sit down from here. I didn't want to take a long time presenting this theme. Again, I want to say welcome. Have a great convention. It's your convention. Enjoy it. And now I'm going to turn it over to our voice, and I've asked Sarah Jane B. to be our voice for the weekend, and she'll come up next. Thank you.
Serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to another day. Following me have been very special in my life. The one who is going to introduce the speaker I first met coming to a convention right here, on the second Al-Anon convention, met at Shoney's. And I haven't missed a year since. So you can tell that I really enjoy these conventions. They mean a lot to me. And these two ladies mean a lot to me. And she's going to introduce our speaker, who was in Al-Anon in Douglas when I started going. And she has really played a big part in my life. And so anything in me that you see that's not acceptable or whatever, you can be sure she's responsible for it. So Doris, would you come and welcome our speaker tonight?
Hi, everybody. My name is Doris Lee, and I'm from St. Simons Island, Georgia. And it's so wonderful to look out and see all these smiling faces and see how much we've grown over the years. I was the second convention chairman, and a lot of what they're experiencing with this one is what we experienced with ours. We didn't have very much money either, and we were kind of starting from scratch. Your speaker for tonight, I didn't know way back then, and I didn't know how much she was going to have a part in my life over the years. But we've traveled many a road together and shared very much. When I was selected to be chairman and I returned home, I received a note in the mail. And that note said, "My name is Betty Cody, and if there's anything I can do to help you, please call on me." That was the only note I received. But I thought if she went to all the trouble to send me a letter and to offer her service, that I would take her up on it. And so we've been sharing practically everything since then. If she doesn't plan it, then I plan it, or vice versa. She used to tell everybody, she'd say to me, "I know that you know where you are, but I don't know where you are." So we've shared many things, and she's been one special lady, so I'd like you to meet Betty Cody.
My name is Betty Cody, and I'm a recovering Al-Anon. And anything you see in me that you can't accept, it starts it. They say pass it on, so Irene passed it to me, and I passed it to Dar. I am happy to be here. I have stood up here in several capacities at this convention. I, too, am a past chairman. And another past chairman sitting over here, Hilda. We had a call this week, Hilda. I have not told you about it. Jim M. called and said that he was sorry he could not be here to repay some of the things that we did to him. I've had a lot of fun right here in this auditorium, and I believe I've had a lot of growth right here in this auditorium. This is more of an honor for me to be invited to speak in my home state than it is to be invited to go out of state. and I want to express my appreciation to the committee for asking me. Because everybody on this committee knows me inside and out. And I've got several sitting here saying, if you don't tell it like it was, we're going to tell you so. So I'm going to try to be honest. I'm going to try to share my experience, strength, hope, and love with you tonight. I was told right before the meeting that if I said the right thing, that I would help one person. So I want to try to do that because I know what the On-On program has meant to me. It has been a lifeline, and I dearly love Al-Anon. It comes first in my life, and then other things follow after that. I wish that I could say that I never have a slip in Al-Anon, but you know, a slip for Al-Anon's is a change in our thinking and our actions, and I still do pitch a fit every now and then, and my husband's shaking his head. In fact, just this week I pitched a fit. And then I made amends, and I don't like to make amends, but I have to do that. I'm up here to share with you tonight in a general way how I was, what happened to me, and how I am today. When I was growing up, I was the only child. And I was an unwanted child, and I know this because my mother would tell me that she did not love me, did not want me, and wished I had never been born. And she would do this when she would get angry with me, and I seem to have had a knack then and sometimes today to make people angry with me. I knew Daddy loved me. He would tell me he loved me, but he would say, "I love you, but I love your mother more." And so I knew I was not first. And I always wanted to be first in somebody's life. And I didn't feel loved. I didn't know what it was to really feel loved. And it took me many years in this program before I was able to actually feel that somebody loved me. They would tell me they did, and I didn't believe them. And it is even hard today for me sometimes to feel that I'm loved. But through the help of this program, I not only can feel love, I can give love. And that's important to me, is to be able to give love. When I was in high school and living in Atlanta, I met my husband. And he was introduced to me as Cody. Now, in the last 2 years, I have tried hard to learn to call him Herb at his request. And I can do it sometimes, but the majority of the time, he's still Cody to me. He has been Cody to me for 41 years of marriage and a few months before that. Now, he's a little older than I am, and he was in college, and he did not particularly like me, but I decided he was what I wanted, so I chased him till he caught me. Now, there was a time that I tried to give him back to an old girlfriend. She had sent me word she wanted him back, and then when he got to drinking, I called her and asked her, did she want him? And this was after about 10 years of marriage or better. I did a lot of things that I'm not proud of. And a lot of things that we can smile about and laugh about and joke about today. But I am here to tell you that they were serious at the time. I did not laugh nor joke at the times these things were going on. But I no longer feel guilt and shame about the things I did either. The On-On program has helped me to deal and understand those things. I was asked just a few months ago, "Well, Betty, why didn't you leave?" And I told them, and I got to thinking about it, anybody I would have gone to was living with me. I had nowhere to go. We had lots of people living with us in our early marriage. Both my parents had strokes and were invalids, and they lived with me, with us. His sister lived with us. His mother stayed with us some. Any relative that did not have anywhere else to go came to us. So I had nowhere to go. Yeah. I did get mad one night and was throwing some clothes in a suitcase, and I looked over and he was throwing some clothes in a suitcase, and I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I don't know. Where are you going?" "I'm going with you." And I thought, well, good God, if I got to take you three youngins and a parents, I don't need to go nowhere. So I stayed at home. And that's sort of how things were going at my house, you know. I'm going to share some of the things that I did that people like to hear. And I like to talk about recovery, but they like to hear all of these things that I did. And I have a job today that I just dearly love. And I really enjoy my job. But I was told that they looked around and looked for the sickest person they could find in Al-Anon and offered them this job. And that was me. And I am paid twice a week to go to Al-Anon. Now, how many of y'all do that, you know? Paid to go to meetings. So, you know, Al-Anon does have some good effects. A lot of our drinking stories, and I say our drinking stories, I didn't drink and I don't smoke and I do very little cussing, but I began to get as sick in alcoholism as my spouse. And we moved to Alma, Georgia. My husband's father had died, and he was told to quit his job and me to quit my job and us to move to South Georgia. And he's the only boy and the youngest child, and I was, and we did. We did just what we was told to do. And when we moved to Alma, Georgia, our illness really began. We bought a business. Now, we went to the bank, and we snowed them, and we borrowed the money to even put in the cash register to make change. And this was an office supply and printing business. Now, I didn't know too much about either one of them. And we hired a printer. And we worked hard in this business. And we prospered in this business. And the more we prospered, the more he began to drink. And he told me one day, he says, "I don't hunt, I don't fish, and I don't run around on you, so I'm entitled to drink." That was his hobby, he told me. And sometime later, I looked at him and I says, "I don't hunt, and I don't fish, and I don't run around on you, and my hobby is bitching." And I got as proficient in my hobby as he was in his. So you can tell what our household was like. Now, the things I'm going to tell you I can share in just a few minutes, but they happened over a period of time. Now, I'm not going into all of the times that he was put into treatment facilities and into hospitals. We just don't have that much time. And I'm not going to tell you about everything I did. We don't have that much time. But I'm going to share three things that really are outstanding and that they're important that I remember. And the things that happened on Wednesday, most of them. No, Thursday. I'm sorry. But one Thursday I went home from work, and by this time I didn't have to get mad. I just stayed mad. And he did not believe in working on Thursday. That was a good drinking day. And I went home, and he was drinking, and he got up out of bed, and he told me that we were going to Hazelhurst. Well, I told him I hadn't lost anything in Hazelhurst, didn't intend to find anything in Hazelhurst, and I wasn't going to Hazelhurst. And you could ask him today, do we argue, and he would say no, because he doesn't want to admit that we do. Well, we may not argue, but let me tell you, we have some good, healthy, loud discussions. And I'm a little louder than he is. I can outshout him. But that day he says, we're going, and you're going to drive. Well, he very seldom tells me I'm going to do anything because he knows I get stubborn then. But we had this healthy discussion, and we did go to Hazelhurst, and I did drive. And the madder I get, the faster I drive. And I have a tendency, just a little bit, to drive fast anyway. And this, to my knowledge, is the first time that this man ever told me he wished he were dead. And, I, you know, that sounded like a pretty good idea to me. And I knew up ahead was a bridge with a concrete railing. And I thought, well, I'll just hit that ridge, you know, that railing, and get rid of this fella. And then I thought, well, you stupid fool, you're in this car too. And what's going to happen if you hit that bridge is you're going to kill you and mangle him, and the kids are not going to have any insurance and a drunk daddy. So I swerved. Well, insurance then and insurance now, this very day, still plays a part in my life. I have not changed in that one. When it comes due, I want it paid. I don't care where you pay it with a good check or a bad check. I just want to pay. And I still feel that way. Because I figured way back then, and I still think it's a good idea, that if he were to die, and we owed them some money, that they could just deduct what I owe them from what they owe me. So I want it paid. So that's how he didn't die that time. And time marches on, and he continues to drink, and we both get sicker and sicker, and the kids are not speaking to us, and oh, it's just a mess everywhere you'd go. And I go home on another Thursday, and he's in his bed drunk again. You know, that's all he did was drink. And we probably wouldn't have had a lot of arguments if I'd have just kept my mouth shut. And you know, I would say, I'm not going to argue this time. I'm just not going to argue this time. And the doorknob would turn and my mouth would open and here we'd go, you know. And I know I called one time. He didn't go to bars very much, but I called the American Legion one night and told them to tell him to come home. And I meant right now. In about 5 minutes, he drove up to the house, and he says, I wasn't there when you called a while ago. He's always denied being there, but how do you know I called, you know? But that's how it was, you know, that's how it was. And we lived in this little place. Alma's not very large, and we brought a lady with us today, and we rode her through Alma. And everybody knew my business. I had good neighbors. They'd call me and say, he just took a drink and he put the bottle behind the spare tire in the trunk. But if they'd give him just 2 more minutes, he'd be home, you know. But another Thursday came along. I went home and he's drunk and I'm mad. And things had really been rough at our house. I mean, really rough. And my children did hunt, and there were all kind of guns there, rifles and pistols and whatever. And between the children and the neighbors and everybody else, they thought they had all the guns out of the house. But he, in his smart, sarcastic way, told me, well, if I had a gun, I'd shoot myself. I thought, that's a pretty good idea, too. So I went in my bathroom and got me a chair and climbed up and got that gun off of that closet shelf. I loaded it. It's been the only gun that I have ever loaded. And laid it down on the bed by him and said, there, now, there's a gun. Shoot yourself. And I'd walk by him and I'd look at him and I'd say, you hadn't shot yourself yet? Well, I'm not a late night person. About 11 o'clock, I'm getting tired. And I stand by the bed and I said, are you going to shoot yourself? And he said, no, you do it. I mean, here we are just having this conversation. Like two normal people. And I finally told him, I said, well, if you're going to shoot yourself, would you just get down on the floor and do it? Because we couldn't have carpet because of wheelchairs and crutches and all this kind of stuff. And I said, then I could just mop up the blood and you wouldn't mess up my bed and I could just holler for Marvin, that was the undertaker, to come get him. Because the funeral home was just a block and a half down from us and I could have screamed that loud, you know, to come get him. And I said, you got on a white shirt and all I'd have to do is just cross your arms and take off. Ready to go. And we argued and argued and carried on, you know. And he said, will you do it? I said, no, you got to do it so it'd be double indemnity. You know. And I was serious. So we played this game for a while. You know, I know today it was a game, but I didn't know it then. You know, I was serious then. This is how sick we can get, or I got. And I went on up down to the other end of my house, and I went to bed. I don't know what happened to that gun. There's a gun in our house today, but I don't know that that's the one. And I hadn't wanted to kill him bad enough to get the gun out recently. And I'm grateful for that. So he didn't get shot by me or by himself. The time marches on. He continues to drink. That's his hobby. I get really proficient in mine. I continue to bitch, fuss, nag, and have healthy discussions. And it got to be another Thursday. I can tell these things in just a little while, but they happened over a period of months. And this man had been in and out of hospitals and treatment facilities, and I'd throw him in and they'd throw him out and they'd say, don't you ever bring him back here again. You know, I thought, you're crazy. Yeah. But anyway, I go home and he's drunk in the bed. And we started in and he told me again that he wished he were dead. And I thought, yes, you son of a bitch. I wish you were dead and I'll finish you off this day. Because you see, we had a little farm and there's some wild dogs out there that had been killing the calves. And he had gone to the drugstore and bought some strychnine. At that time, all you had to do was go ask Barton and sell it to you. And he would put it in hamburger meat and throw it out, and the wild dogs would eat it, and it would kill the dogs, and they'd leave the calves alone. And I thought, well, good enough then, it's good enough him. So I got my little old trusty chair and climbed up and got that strychnine off that closet shelf where that gun had been. And I go in the kitchen and get me a spoon, and I put a spoonful of it, and I had the bottle in one hand, the spoon in the other, and I'm trying to get him to open his mouth. And he's gritting his teeth and shaking his head. Now, you see, I know today how to do it. You put one of them down. You free one hand. Don't have that much sense in. And the telephone rang, and I stopped and answered the phone. And it was the guy that worked for us, and his name was Bruce, and he always called me Buddy. And he told me, he says, Buddy, are you coming back to work today? And I told him, no, I was busy. And he said, well, I really need you to come back to work and help, says we got a print job that needs to get out. And I said, I can't come back to work today, I'm busy. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm killing Cody. Well, he asked me again, and I told him again, you know, and he wanted to know why, and I go through this spiel that he wanted to be dead, and I wanted him dead, and, you know, and I was finishing him off. And I said, I haven't got time to talk to you, and I hung up. Well, the back of the Baptist church right across the street, and he called the preacher, and he asked the preacher to come over there and see about me. So the preacher came over and he knocked on the front door and I could look out the window and I saw who was there. So I just didn't bother to go to the front door. But he came around to the back and came in and he came in the house and he said, what are you doing? And I felt like I had explained to everybody in the county that I was killing the son of a bitch. And I told him, and he said, what have you got? And I told him, he said, give it to me. I said, open your mouth. Well, we fought over that bottle of strychnine. And he won. And he called a doctor friend of ours and says, Olin, I think you need to come. She's flipped her lid. And Olin and his wife did come and stayed with me the rest of that night. Olin told me later that he thought I had completely gone over the border of sanity, that I was no longer sane. How little he knew that I really was not sane. I am grateful today to tell you that I have a little more sanity today than I had at that time. And that makes me feel good to know, you know, I'm growing a little bit in that area. And that's how I didn't die with strychnine. I couldn't get his mouth open. In the paper, I read about a guy who was working with AAs, and I called him. And he told me who he was, and I told him who I was, and he drove 30 miles that night to see me. And this is when Al-Anon came into my life. I will be forever grateful to Jack Kay for coming when I needed him so desperately. And he told me to go to Al-Anon, and I said, what is that? And he said, it will help his drinking. Now, Jack lied to me. You know, I really don't know what Jack said. That's what I thought he said, and I started going to Al-Anon in Douglas, Georgia. Now, I wish that I could say that I was one of the people that went, and the first meeting I immediately started getting it, you know, and I was ready for the steps, and I was ready for the program, but I didn't like you, I didn't like me, I didn't like nobody in there, and I darn sure didn't like the steps. And they kept telling me I had to change and there wasn't nothing wrong with me. And they told me I had a bad attitude and I thought my attitude was just fine. And one night this little lady came up to me and she tapped me on the shoulder and she says, I've been hearing you bitch and gripe and moan for about 18 months now. You need a sponsor and I'm it. And I looked down at her and I said, I don't like you either. And she says, you don't have to. And I thought, who do you think you are? The next morning, by 8 o'clock, she had driven 25 miles and was sitting at my kitchen table, and she says, now we are going to start working this program. And I said, I don't want to. I don't drink, and it's not my problem. She says, it certainly is. And she said a lot of other things to me. And I'd go to the meeting, and I did go to the meeting because Jack had told me if I didn't go, he's going to come get me. Now, I was stupid, but I wasn't dumb, and Jack was a big man, is a big man. He's about 6'6", somewhere in that area, and weighed about 300 pounds, and, you know, I was little back then, and he could have made me go. And I'd go on Tuesday night, and I'd tell Alice, I've done this, that, and the other, and she'd say, that's fine, but these are some of the things you hadn't done. I couldn't please her. It didn't matter what I did, I couldn't please her. And I kept going to meetings just to spite her. I thought, I'm going to please you one of these old days. I'm going to make it. I will please you. But you know, for whatever reason, I went. And I did begin to listen. And I did begin to want to know what you had to say. And because there was laughter in there, and I'd tell them, well, if you live what I'm living with, you wouldn't laugh either, you know. And my husband did go to some AA meetings. Now, I grant you, he went drunk, but he went. And they'd have to hold him in the chairs, but they did, because he'd just sort of slide at them, you know. Douglas Group has got a real special place in my heart. I want you to know that we're the only ones that I've ever heard of that the group voted to let us keep coming. Because we was breaking up the group. But there was three AA men, and one of them had about 15 years of sobriety, and one of them had 25 years of sobriety, and the other one didn't have but about 10 or 12. And they took me under their wing. And I'm grateful for that. A lot of people say Al-Anon shouldn't have AA sponsors, but I needed it. And Barney would talk with me and work with me and call me and just spend a lot of time with me. And the next Tuesday at a meeting, he'd put his arm around my shoulder and walk me over to Mr. Mack, and he'd say, Mr. Mack, she's yours this week. And Mr. Mack would spend a lot of time and talk. And now, you see, they leave him the drunk alone. They ain't even bothering him. They wouldn't talk to him. And then the next week, Mr. Mack would put his arm around my shoulder and walk me over to Pete and say, Pete, she's yours this time. We've had all we can stand. And they was telling me these things to my face now. They wasn't telling them to my back. Yeah. And those three men hung in there with me. It took three AAs, but just one little Al-Anon, she just hung right in there. I couldn't shake her loose. And I'm grateful for that today. We decided, no, we didn't decide, I decided, that he needed to go to one more treatment facility. He didn't go willingly, I'm telling you that. He did not go willingly. And he'd been up there about a week, and he sent me word that he was leaving, he was coming home. And I wrote him one letter. And I told him who he was and who he wasn't and where he could go, and it was not to Alma, Georgia, if he left there. So he stayed. He tells people today, he says, when they complain about not getting any mail, he said, he didn't either. And people say, well, how often did you call about him? Not the first time. You know, I needed some relief. I needed some help. And I'm not particularly proud of those things, and I wouldn't particularly advise those things today, but that's what it took for me. For me. And he did stay. And they called me, and I was to go up and stay 2 days, and I told the nurse just exactly what I thought about her and where she could go and what she could do with a family visit. And then Dr. John called me and told me where I could go and what I could do with a family visit, and I'd better be up there the next day. Well, that was the second big man that had played a part in my life. And I did go. And they spent a lot of time with me. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try to work this program. I'm really going to try to work. And I have learned to listen to what he says, not what I think he says. And you know, he didn't drink like that again until Thursday morning. And Thursday morning, he was drunk again. And I thought, okay, okay, I'll work this program. And I took him to the doctor and I got him a $15 shot. That's the price of it's always stood out in my mind. I don't know why, it just has. And I bathed his brow and I fed him milkshakes and I did everything I was supposed to do to the best that I could do it. And we got over that drunk. 3 weeks later, he was drunk again. And I thought, oh, feller, if drink is what you want to do, drink is what you're going to do till you die. And it had not been long since I had gone to a lawyer and filed for divorce, and he asked me what I wanted, and I told him, you know, at that time we had something. Today I wouldn't even bother going to a lawyer, we ain't got nothing. But then we did have. And you know, this lawyer was representing me and him in our divorce action. And I was on my way to court to get my divorce, and I had stopped at our store, and I looked at him, and he was drunk and sick. Oh, he was so sick. And I said, come on, I'll take you home. Now, see, I put him out because he's drunk. Now I'm taking him home because he's drunk. No consistency. But this time I called me a different lawyer. And I asked him if it was a legal death if I gave him enough alcohol to drink till he died. Now, sort of keep this thing in the family, I called my sister-in-law's son-in-law. And he hauled around and told me I couldn't do that. And I said, yes, I can. And he says, you don't want to do that. And I said, yes, I do. What I want to know, is it a legal death and will it be accidental? Will it be double indemnity? And I didn't tell him that I had already talked to the sheriff of our county and asked him that if Cody just happened to die, would he help me make it look accidental? I mean, you know, good normal people go to the sheriff and ask him these things before it happens, you know. But, I went to the liquor store, and we used to talk about what size vodkas. I bought Smirnoff 100 proof. I bought 8 bottles, and I paid $32 and a dime, and it was bad check. I probably didn't even have a dime in the bank, you know, but I wrote the check. It didn't matter to me, because we was all writing bad checks, me, him, and everybody else. And took them home, and I lined them up. I'd see them as if they were sitting right here in front of me right now. I put 4 and 4. I said, you want a drink? And he said, yeah. Well, I had me a little shot glass there, and I'd fill it full of vodka, and I'd give it to him, and he'd drink it. And as the day went on, he couldn't sort of hold his head up, you know. And so I'd hold his head in one hand, that shot glass with vodka in it, and another, and I'd pour it down him. And people came, and they said, you killing him? I'd say, yeah. Yeah, I had the lawyer to come by, the doctor to come by, a couple of AA men from Douglas to come by, and they kept saying, you're killing them. I'd say, yeah, that's what I'm doing. You can't do that. Yes, I can. You know, just calm, cool about it. And finally locked all the doors so nobody could come in. But I got tired of that mess, you know. There wasn't anybody there but me and him at that particular time. And it was cold. Icicles was on the trees, so you can tell it was cold. And twice he asked me for a drink of water, and I went in the kitchen and filled up a tea pitcher with ice and water and carried it back in the bedroom and poured it upside down on him and let him lick his lips, and what he licked, he got. So after the second time, he didn't ask me for no more water, and I didn't offer him none. About 11 o'clock, we out. I mean, he has drank every drop in them 8 bottles. And I asked him, I said, you want a drink? If you do now, I'll go back to the liquor store. It's not closed. I'll write another check. I'll get some more. And he said, oh, good God, no. So I went down the other end of the house and went to bed. He says he had a bad night. He said he crawled to the bathroom and mess he made, I just left it and let him clean it up. you know, and I hope he did have a bad night. But the next day, first thing when I got up the next morning, I said, "You want another drink?" He said, "Oh, good God, no." And from that day to this one, he has not had another drink. But that Wednesday, it got time for an Al-Anon meeting, and I said, "I'm going to the meeting." I did not ask him if he wanted to go. But he said, "If you'll help me get ready, I'll go to the meeting." And I looked at him and I said, "Get ready the best way you can. That's what I'm doing." And I did drive to the meeting. And we got there and he said, "Will you help me in?" I said, "No. Get in there the best way you can. That's what I'm doing." And I went inside to the meeting. Now, I've just told you that I've been going for 2 years. And you know that in 2 years they've been reading the steps. But that night, and I believe in my heart of hearts, that I began a new life December the 12th of 1973 at around 9 o'clock at night. I heard the 11th step read. That's the first step I ever truly heard. And I prayed, "God, I've got to change. Whether he ever gets sober or not, I cannot go on this way." I took part of the third step. I made a decision to change. And I took part of the first step. I admitted that my life was unmanageable. Now, I know that I took all these steps backwards, but that's what it took for me. I have since had to go back many times and work these steps from one forward. But that time, I started 11, 3, and 1. Our life did begin to change. We were doing okay. And for about the next 10 years, we did do okay. Not great, but okay. We ended up losing everything we had ever worked for. Not just because of alcoholism, but that played a part. And other things began to happen. Our son was arrested for growing marijuana. Now you can tell that we don't do things little. We do it big time. Now I think they said 50 acres of marijuana, you know. So we stayed in court with that. We had a son getting divorced, and it was a very ugly child custody battle, and we stayed in court with that. Me and the judge and me and the district attorney and me and the sheriff and all the lawyers were on first name basis. Real friendly, you know. I'm grateful to say that in the trial for my son, he was found innocent. I have never asked him, was he guilty or innocent? Because by then, Al-Anon had said, if you don't want the answers, don't ask the questions. And I didn't ask that question. I just said, I love you and I support you. This is the same son who for 7.5 years had nothing to do with me. He would come in this room and not speak to me, because I had hurt him emotionally, not physically, but emotionally. And it took him that long to begin to forgive me. I told him one day that I wished that he loved me a tenth as much as he loved his dad, because he had said he loved his daddy better than anything in this world. And Steve's taller than I am, and he looked down at me and he said, I don't love you, but I respect you. And you see, the program could let me accept that. Today, that young man loves me, and he tells me that he does. And I'm grateful. Al-Anon gave me that. Al-Anon and the AA program. They gave me that relationship with my child. Today, my family is a close-knit family. We're not together all the time. But our middle son was also hurt by his dad's drinking. You see, that's why we so firmly believe that it is a family illness. My middle son is the one that his dad tried to run over with a truck and tried to hurt during the drinking days. But we have a letter in our house that says, "Dad, there are few men that I respect, but you are the top of my totem pole." That's what the program has given to us. This same son has given us a trip to Europe this summer. In fact, we leave next weekend to go to Germany to visit him. The program, we could not have done that without the two programs working in our lives. A spiritual program I have today and a God of my understanding I have today. You heard me tell about the times that I tried to kill him and that I prayed that he would die. Now I'm going to tell you about the time that I prayed for this same man to live. And there's some people sitting in here today that went through that with me. They were there when my husband had to have heart surgery. And they told me he may not live to come off the table, the condition that he's in. But you see, I'd heard that many times. He had had a wreck and had been in the hospital for months on end, and they had told me he would not live. And that was when I'd pray for him to die. I'm not proud of that either. And neither am I proud that when I started to plan his funeral, I decided where he needed to be buried, and I thought he would be happy in the hog lot, and I chose to bury him in the hog lot if he were to die. That's the time that I refused to call my children and his family in when they told me he was going to die and said, "Well, let him die." You know, that's where I was at that time. But then this time when they said he may not live to come off the table, I prayed that this man would live, that we could continue to try to build a firm foundation and a relationship with each other. Even if we do have healthy discussions and they sometimes get loud on my part. And God did spare him. I laugh and tell. I told him today, you know, if we can live about 3 more months, we got you paid for. And because we had, at one time, we had doctor and hospital bills till I told the kids, "That's your inheritance. Pay the doctors and hospitals." But if we make it about 2 or 3 more months, we're going to have him paid for. And I'm grateful for that. God did hear my prayers, and he did spare him. And we do. We work together, we sleep together, we eat together, we live together, and sometimes I say, "I'm tired." He says, "Of what?" I said, "Of you. Can you leave a little while?" Because we're together all the time. But we enjoy being together. I know today that God loves me. I know my children, my grandchildren love me. And I know that I have friends out there that return my love because I love them and they love me for what I am, not what I can give them. I know today that Al-Anon and AA are first in our lives, that because without these programs, we wouldn't have a life. And we do today. We don't have much materially, but we have what we want. And we have a family, and that's important. This has been a time of growth for me. And you know, I sometimes say, well, God, I'm tired of growing. I don't want to grow no more. I'm through. You know, just let me rest. And God sort of smiles at me and says, no, it's not time yet, Betty. You know, and that's, I just keep plugging on. I got a resentment against somebody here not long ago, and Cody says, read the big book, read the big book. I told him I didn't want to read the big book, you know. And he says, acceptance, acceptance. Pray for him. So I said, God, I don't like them, but you do, so you give them what they deserve. Yeah. Well, that may not have been a nice way to pray, but that's how I felt that day, and that's best I could do that day, and I've done a little better since. But the program tells me as long as I try, you know, just try. Just hang in there and try. But what I want to say tonight is if you're new in the program, please, for God's sakes, don't let my talk scare you off. Everybody doesn't get as sick as I did. But we all get sick in our own way. And if you want to get better, it's here. If you want it. Everybody's willing to give you an open hand and an open heart if you just accept it. You don't have to like it, but just accept it. It's okay if you remember the funny things that you thought were funny. That's okay with me too. But my prayer is that you remember the hope that I hold out to you. Because if I can get better, anybody can get better. And I may not be well, but I am better. I'm able to have fun today. I'm able to laugh and love. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you.